Good day to you. This is Kathy Boughton, volunteer reader for Sunstands of Arizona. I am going to be reading from The Week.
And we'll start off with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump defends $400 million jet gift on Mideast tour. What happened? President Trump this week embarked on a pomp-filled tour of the Middle East, where he signed investment deals with Saudi Arabia, pledged to lift U.S. sanctions on Syria, made overtures to Iran, and sparked domestic uproar with his plan to accept Qatar's gift of $400 million jet. Trump scoffed at ethical concerns about receiving a lavishly appointed Boeing 747-8 from the Qatari royal family, saying the palace in the sky would be converted into an Air Force One and would go to his presidential library after he left office. Only a stupid person wouldn't want a free, very expensive airplane, said Trump. In a memo, Attorney General Pam Bondi, a former lobbyist for Qatar, declared the gift would not violate anti-bribery laws or the Constitution's ban on foreign gifts, because it would go initially to the Defense Department. But even many Republicans balked at the plan. Qatar's rulers support Hamas, said Florida Senator Rick Scott. I don't know how you make the plane safe. As Trump arrived in Saudi Arabia, his first stop, he got a ceremonial escort from six Royal Saudi Air Force F-15s and was met by an honor guard with golden swords. Sitting with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman under sparkling chandeliers in the royal palace, Trump praised the kingdom's de facto ruler as an incredible man and my friend. In Riyadh, Trump announced he would lift decades-old sanctions on Syria to give the war-ravaged country a chance at peace. The next day, he met with Syrian President Ahmad al-Sharaa, a former al-Qaeda militant who led the recent overthrow of dictator Bashar al-Assad, praising him as a tough guy. Trump noted that he decided to lift sanctions after a request from bin Salman. What I do for the crown prince, he said. Trump offered a new path to Iran, promising to ease sanctions if it abandoned its nuclear program and support of proxy militias. Should Tehran reject this olive branch, he said, we will have no choice but to inflict massive, maximum pressure. During the trip, bin Salman committed to $600 billion in U.S. investments, including $142 billion in arms purchases. Qatar, Trump's second stop, pledged deals worth more than $243 billion, including $96 billion in Boeing jets for Qatar Airways. What the editorial said? Trump's belief he can blithely accept a $400 million plane from Qatar is jaw-dropping, said the San Antonio Express News. It's a blatant act of self-enrichment and a clear violation of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, which forbids gifts for U.S. officials from any king, prince, or foreign state. That it technically goes to the Defense Department means nothing. The chief beneficiary will be a corrupt president who is easily swayed by flattery and presence. Making matters worse is that Qatar is no friend, said National Review. Its terrorist-loving government has long supported Yemen's Houthi militia and funneled billions to Hamas, helping the group build the infrastructure it needed for the October 7, 2023 massacre in Israel. It then blamed Israel for the slaughter and refused to use its leverage to help free Hamas's hostages. Absolutely nothing good can come from a president feeling he owes something to such a regime. What the columnist said? Trump visited a region awash in tumult, from the humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza to the missile exchanges between Israel and the Iran-backed Houthis, said Alex Shepard in The New Republic. But actual diplomacy on this trip was an afterthought. Instead, his focus was business, with an uneasy blurring between America's interests and those of Trump, Inc. Eric and Don Jr. have been jaunting across the region, striking deals worth billions of dollars, including a high-end residential tower in Saudi Arabia and a golf course and villa complex in Qatar. Meanwhile, Trump's sidelining of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is unnerving Israelis, said Gary Shee in the Washington Post. His failure to visit Jerusalem comes amid other signs of cracks between the staunch allies. The U.S. has engaged in hostage talks with Hamas without Israel's knowledge, struck a truce with the Houthis that didn't protect Israel, and moved to start nuclear negotiations with Iran while vetoing an Israeli strike on its enemy. Many Israelis now fear they're being cast off by a president they consider to be the most pro-Israel in history. It's telling that for the first planned trip of his second term, Trump chose not a democracy, but a despotism, said William Kristol in The Bulwark. And his gushing praise of bin Salman, a global pariah after he ordered the 2018 murder of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, made clear he admires the Saudi achievements in autocracy, plutocracy, and kleptocracy. Indeed, in remarks at a business summit in Riyadh, he condemned the so-called nation builders, neocons, or liberal nonprofits who have promoted democracy and liberalism in the region. Since Trump returned to office, the specter of authoritarianism has sparked wide alarm, said Edward Luce in Financial Times. But autocracy's twin is kleptocracy, and on that front, Trump seems much further advanced. The Trump family's crypto ventures are raking in millions. His sons are building a Trump-branded golf course in Qatar, which is also a major investor in his son-in-law Jared Kushner's investment fund. It'd be fair to ask the America First president how any of this serves U.S. interests. The suspicion arises that the president's real agenda is Trump First, and the rest is sleight of hand. What next? Trump's free plane would be no gift for the American taxpayer, said Joe Gould and Conor O'Brien in Politico. The two presidential planes currently in use are decades old and increasingly hard to maintain, and replacements are years behind schedule. But before it could be used as Air Force One, the Qatari jet would need to be torn down and rebuilt from the inside out to meet security and communications needs and swept for embedded foreign tech. Experts say that process could cost the government tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars. The furor over the plane could raise the heat on a simmering problem for Trump, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. Polls show many Americans have concerns about his business dealings, and lately we've seen explosive reporting about Trump getting rich off cryptocurrency. While most Americans don't understand crypto, anyone can grasp the taking of an extraordinary gift from an Arab monarchy, a gift that would land just as he asked Americans to embrace austerity in his on-again, off-again trade war. Even for this norm-shattering president, that would be pretty brazen. U.S. hits brakes on trade war with China. What happened? The Trump administration walked back its most aggressive tariffs on China this week, easing a trade war that had effectively halted the shipment of goods between the world's two largest economies. After talks in Geneva, the two sides agreed to a 90-day pause during which the U.S. will lower tariffs on most Chinese goods from 145% to 30%, while China drops its rate on U.S. imports from 125% to 10%. The U.S. will also set the de minimis tariff, which applies to shipments under $800, at 54% for some deliveries from China and 30% for others. Until this month, such low-value shipments, many sent by Chinese e-commerce giants Shein and Temu, had entered the U.S. duty-free. The consensus from both delegations is that neither side wanted a decoupling, said Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who led the U.S. negotiating team. Chinese state media hailed the agreement as vindication for Beijing's defiant posture. The administration also struck a framework trade deal with the UK. The US will keep its 10% global baseline tariff in place, but will reduce or eliminate duties on some British goods, including cars, steel, and aluminum. And the UK will allow in a certain amount of US beef and ethanol duty-free. Even with both deals, though, the overall U.S. tariff rate remains extremely high at 18%, the highest since the 1930s Smoot-Hawley tariffs that worsened the Great Depression. Still, on news of the China deal, the stock market rebounded. Goldman Sachs lowered its assessment of the risk of recession from 45% to 35%, although economists said a slowdown appears unavoidable. What the columnist said? Both these trade deals represent major retreats by President Trump in his own trade war, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The British deal was more show than substance, while the China deal is more surrender than Trump victory. The good news is that China and the U.S. have stepped back from the brink of mutual assured trade destruction. The enormous reduction in tariff rates on Chinese imports will, by one estimate, add up to $300 billion in tariff relief for the U.S. That's a huge tax reprieve. Yet it's only a reprieve from self-inflicted damage, said J.J. McCorvey in NBCNews.com. Trump's original sky-high tariffs would have cost U.S. households an average of $4,900 per year, according to the Yale Budget Lab. Reportedly, it was the warning that his own voters would suffer that helped persuade the president to reverse himself. But the new tariff rates will cost the average household $2,800. That's still a big price to pay, and this trade war is far from over. It's unclear what the end goal is here, said Nick Cattagio in the Dispatch. What was the rationale for tariffs? To make China crack down on fentanyl trafficking? To decouple our economy from theirs, forcing America to rebuild its manufacturing base by thrusting the country into autarky? To get China to lower its trade barriers, which would be helpful? It was none of these. There was no plan. Trump just wanted to dial up the tariffs and see what happens. There's a plan, all right. A nefarious one, said David Frum in The Atlantic. Tariffs are regressive taxes, remember. They tax the goods that poor people buy, but not the services that rich people use. The working man's car is tariffed. The rich man's chauffeur is not tariffed. That means the tariffs enable a fiscal redistribution from poor to rich. Trump is trying to balance his tax cuts for billionaires by making average Americans pay more for goods. And tariffs have another advantage. Unlike corporate income taxes, they can be waived for firms and individuals who do Trump's bidding or give him money. Does Trump even have the power to do this? Asked Ian Milheiser in Vox. A federal statute grants the president tariff authority in the event of an unusual and extraordinary threat. But Trump's justification for invoking these emergency powers is the trade deficit, which has existed for decades. Small businesses are currently challenging the tariffs at the U.S. Court of International Trade, and skeptical questions from the three-judge panel suggest it could well rule all of Trump's new tariffs unlawful. In that case, the administration would appeal. It's the Supreme Court that's likely to have the final word. It wasn't all bad. Calvin, a North Atlantic right whale believed to be about 33 years old, was spotted in April for the first time in 3 years after scientists feared she died from running into discarded debris. She is one of only 370 right whales left on the planet. Calvin was found healed in a pod of over 60 whales off Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. Although orphaned at 8 months, she has given birth 4 times and survived 8 similar injuries, illustrating the resiliency of right whales, said scientist Catherine McKenna. NASA astronaut Don Pettit returned to Earth on his birthday last month with a special present, space magic, captured on camera. The 70-year-old finished his fourth space trip with a collection of images he took on board the International Space Station, showing everything from dwarf galaxies near the Milky Way to auroras dancing above our planet's surface. His high-resolution shots were captured with the help of a homemade device that pivots slowly to counteract the station's motion. Although Pettit is NASA's oldest active astronaut, he doesn't plan to stay planted on Earth. I could see getting another flight or two in before I'm ready to hang up my rocket nozzles. After his daughter's 15th birthday, Andy McKelveen offered to give guest Jacob Bellow a ride home, only to discover that Bellow was homeless. 6 months later, McKelveen, a police officer in Chandler, Arizona, and his wife let Bellow move into their home and gained guardianship over him. He became a part of the family, and 14 years later, McKelveen pinned a police badge onto his adopted son after he completed training at the police academy. Bellow hugged a crying McKelveen and said he'd remember the moment forever. "It felt like I'm taking on the legacy that he's left behind." Controversy of the Week. Leo XIV, What American Pope Can Teach America. Growing up, the only white smoke young Robert Prevost ever saw likely billowed from steelworks chimneys on Chicago's south side, said Dylan Dijah in The Observer, UK. Last week, white smoke from the Vatican signaled that he'd been elected the first North American pope in the history of the Catholic Church. Adopting the name Leo XIV, the new pontiff addressed the crowds in St. Peter's Square first in Italian, then in Spanish, and concluded with a traditional blessing in Latin. But make no mistake, the new leader of the world's 1.4 billion Catholics is a true son of Chicago. Known to friends as Bob, he's a White Sox fan from the intimate and humane city that gave the world Barack Obama, deep dish pizza, and Playboy magazine. The Cardinal's choice of an American has stunned the Roman Catholic world, said Jason Horowitz in the New York Times. It breaks an old taboo against aligning papal authority with the world's dominant superpower. But Prevost, a young but not too young 69, spent 20 years ministering to the poor in Peru, acquiring a Peruvian passport along the way, and the fact that he was born in a wealthy nation whose donors are vital to the church's finances may have ultimately worked in his favor. The new pope is American, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark, but do not, for one second, think this is about us. Within minutes of Leo's election, MAGA keyboard warriors had surfaced a social media account bearing Prevost's name that had reposted articles criticizing the Trump administration's deportation policies and declared Vice President J.D. Vance wrong for interpreting Catholic doctrine as opposing foreign aid. To MAGA influencer Laura Loomer, that made Leah a woke Marxist pope, presumably elected to give Trump a new nemesis. In reality, Leo's message of peace — he used his first Sunday blessing to call for ceasefires in Gaza and Ukraine — and compassion for the downtrodden just means he's a Catholic. We'll never know exactly why the cardinals picked him, but trust me that no one in the Sistine Chapel was thinking about Trump. Really? Said Jill Philibeck in the Daily Beast. The Trump years have seen the rise of a hard-right Catholic opposition to the values of empathy and tolerance that Pope Francis preached. Liberals shouldn't kid themselves that any pope will hold progressive views on abortion, say, or gay marriage. And Leo's past statements suggest he's a traditional conservative on those issues. But the choice of an American pope committed to decency was likely meant as a corrective to the harsh new Catholicism of Vance. Actually, said Michael Brendan Dougherty in National Review, Leo has already walked back some of Francis's modernist reforms. They are small things, but by speaking in confident Latin and choosing a traditional papal name, Leo has signaled to conservatives that he'll be a major improvement over progressive, emotive Francis. Leo is neither MAGA nor woke, said David French in the New York Times. But the example of an American running an ancient church could inspire our brash young nation to widen its frame of reference and stop elevating the temporal over the eternal. For Americans, the Pope has always been unreachable and otherworldly, said Molly Wilson O'Reilly in MSNBC.com. Now he's one of us, able to speak to us directly, with no need for a translator. Sooner or later, Pope Leo from Chicago, flat vowels and all, may choose to engage with us, his countrymen. The question is whether Americans are prepared to listen. Only in America. A new Texas anti-abortion bill contains a provision that would make it impossible to challenge in state court. As well as empowering citizens to sue for $100,000 anyone who distributes abortion pills, SB 2880 would also let citizens recover $100,000 from any state judge who rules on its constitutionality. It's just crazy, said Dallas attorney Charles Siegel. We've never had a system of law under which people get to sue judges for money over their rulings. A McDonald's in Alexandria, Virginia, has banned customers under age 21 from dining inside, following a wave of high schooler brawls. A sign announcing the policy cites repeated incidents of student violence and informs all customers they must now ring a doorbell for entry. Local patron Tim Perkins called the change a great thing, adding, "This is probably the first time in 5 years that I've sat down for 15 minutes in this McDonald's and enjoyed a hamburger." It was a good week for making the most of it, after Dutch scientists concluded that the universe will die much sooner than expected, with all stars set to burn out in 10 to the power of 78 years. That's a 1 with 78 zeros, rather than the previous estimate of 10 to the power of 1,100 years. It was a good week for Charlie Hustle after the MLB removed Pete Rose and other deceased players from its permanently banned list, making them eligible to be considered for induction into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Rose, who was placed on the list for gambling, is no longer with us, said MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred, so cannot represent a threat to the integrity of the game. It was a good week for pathogens after Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. posted photos of himself and his grandkids swimming in Washington, D.C.'s Rock Creek, a sewer runoff with high levels of bacteria. Contact with the water, notes the National Park Service, poses a hazard to human and pet health. It was a bad week for the dark side after a British woman whose psychological makeup was likened by a colleague to that of Darth Vader, was awarded $40,000 in compensation. Judge Catherine Ramsden was unmoved by defense claims that the Sith Lord is a very focused individual who can bring teams together, ruling that Vader is a legendary villain. It was a bad week for flaunting it after the Cannes Film Festival banned nudity on the red carpet for reasons of decency, as well as prohibiting the kind of beyond-revealing outfits worn by celebrities like Bella Hadid. The new code also restricts voluminous outfits, particularly those with a large train. It was a bad week for goodie bags after Detroit police shut down the legendary Sting strip club for hosting a birthday party attended by more than 20 minors, some as young as 14. "We will not tolerate this in the city of Detroit," said Police Chief Todd Bettison, "not at this establishment or any other." In other news, Trump seeks to replace Librarian of Congress. President Trump fired the first Black Librarian of Congress last week and named Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, his former personal lawyer, as acting librarian. Carla Hayden had 1 year remaining in her 10-year term, but White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said there were quite concerning things she had done at the Library of Congress in the pursuit of DEI and putting inappropriate books in the library for children. The Library of Congress is primarily a research center reserved for people 16 and over, but it has a children's reading room. Last week, Trump also fired the head of the library's copyright office, who had recently issued a report questioning the legality of training AI on copyrighted works. Staff at the library, which is part of the legislative branch, turned away two Trump administration officials sent to take over the library and its copyright office, saying they needed direction from Congress. The U.S. at a glance. San Francisco. Layoffs blocked. A federal judge last week ordered a pause on President Trump's executive order for tens of thousands of layoffs at the State Department, the Treasury, and 18 other agencies. Following a hearing with lawyers representing unions, nonprofits, and municipalities, U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston concluded the layoffs threatened critical services such as disaster relief, mine safety inspections, and Social Security appointments, and exceeded Trump's authority. Presidents may imprint their stamp on the federal government, she wrote, but a leader seeking such a vast overhaul must involve Congress. The drastic layoff plans were driven largely by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency. Some agencies, such as the Department of Health and Human Services, have already moved forward with layoffs, upending services across the country. The Justice Department immediately appealed the ruling. Los Angeles, true crime. The Menendez brothers became eligible for parole this week when they were resentenced to 50 years to life for murdering their parents in 1989, the latest development in a case that has captured the nation's attention for decades. Lyle and Eric Menendez shot and killed their parents in their Beverly Hills mansion when they were 21 and 18. They were sentenced to life in prison without parole in 1996. The two said their father, entertainment executive Jose Menendez, sexually abused them for years, but the 1996 judge limited evidence and testimony about the abuse. Yet they've since attracted sympathizers, aided by documentaries and docuseries introducing them to a younger generation, who argue they were unfairly treated. Relatives and corrections officials spoke in support of the brothers, leading Judge Michael Jessick to determine they've done enough over the past 35 years to have that chance at parole. They'll appear before California's parole board next month. Newark, New Jersey. Civil disobedience. Newark Mayor Ross Baraka was arrested for allegedly trespassing at a new immigration detention center in his city last week during a chaotic confrontation between lawmakers and immigration officials. Baraka, a Democrat running for governor, visited the facility with three Democratic Congress members from New Jersey. Officials let Baraka through the front gates of Delaney Hall, which began receiving detainees this month, but prevented him from accompanying the Congress members inside. Videos show Baraka then joined protesters outside, but masked federal agents in military fatigues arrested him on public property once the Congress members had also exited. He was released after 5 hours. Department of Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin called Baraka's behavior a bizarre political stunt. DHS later said that the Congress members, Representatives Bonnie Watson Coleman, Rob Menendez, and LaMonica McIver, could also face assault charges over the incident. Washington, D.C. Unprotected. The Trump administration this week announced it will lift a block on deporting Afghan citizens living in the U.S. in July, putting over 9,000 Afghans at risk of deportation. The administration argued that conditions in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan have improved enough that Afghans no longer need temporary protected status, TPS, which shields migrants when conditions in their home countries make deportation too dangerous. The Biden administration granted TPS to Afghans after the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan in 2021, as conditions in the country deteriorated under the Taliban's rule. It was extended in 2023. Most of the 80,000 Afghans who came to the U.S. after the fall of Kabul have secured more permanent status, either via asylum applications or special immigrant visas for Afghans who worked alongside U.S. personnel. But the Trump administration has argued that bad actors have taken advantage of the humanitarian program. We'll look at a couple of articles from The World at a Glance. Stockholm. No to Trump. City officials in Stockholm said they were baffled to receive a letter last week from the U.S. Embassy demanding they dismantle their diversity and equity programs if they want to do business with the Trump administration. The White House has sent such directives to U.S. cities, but the Stockholm letter is believed to be the first sent to a foreign one. Swedish officials said they had no intention of complying, knowing that Swedish, not U.S. laws, apply in Sweden. It's so bizarre, said Stockholm Vice Mayor Jan Valskog. Diversity, equity, and inclusion are values that we strive for. He suggested that the U.S. Embassy might in fact deign to do business with city officials the next time it needs a building permit. Mexico City, suing over Gulf of America. Mexico is suing Google for changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America on its maps, President Claudia Sheinbaum said last week. President Trump signed an executive order in February ordering the name change. Sheinbaum said she had warned Google that any Trump decree could apply only to U.S. waters. The U.S. government can only call the portion of the U.S. continental shelf the Gulf of America, not the entire Gulf, because it wouldn't have the authority to name the entire Gulf, she said. Sheinbaum said if the U.S. wants to rename things, it should call itself Mexican America, since it took over a third of Mexico in 1948 under the treaty that ended the Mexican-American War. People. A Life Among Rock Royalty. Chris O'Dell sang with the Beatles and bought drugs for Keith Richards, said Christian Kritikos in The Guardian. And as a longtime assistant and tour manager for top rock bands, she has many more stories to tell. Her adventures began in 1968 when O'Dell, then 21 and working in radio promotion in Los Angeles, was offered a job in London at the Beatles label, Apple. She set up the office with Paul McCartney, joined the na-na-na-na refrain on Hey Jude, and moved in with George Harrison and his wife. One morning, I came down and every newspaper was on the table saying, Paul quits. It seemed so abrupt and unexpected, says O'Dell. She went to work for the Rolling Stones, not only scoring drugs for Richards, but indulging alongside him. He said, you know, Chris, you can keep up with the guys. I thought that was a compliment then. Today, I don't quite see it that way. Working on a Bob Dylan tour, O'Dell landed in a bit of a love triangle with Joni Mitchell and playwright Sam Shepard. This dude had a wife back in California. What was wrong with us? The experience inspired the lines in Mitchell's 1976 song, Coyote, about a woman at home and another woman down the hall. I am that woman down the hall. Winter's teenage torment. Ariel Winter went through puberty in public, said Jillian Telling in People, and it's a trauma she's still recovering from. The actress, who played the bookish Alex Dunphy on Modern Family, was only 11 when the sitcom debuted in 2009. As she entered her teen years, she endured brutal comments about her appearance. It was just everywhere, says Winter, now 27. It was every headline I read about myself, like grown people writing articles saying how I look terrible or pregnant or like a fat slut
The endless trolling hammered her self-esteem. I was 14. It made it very difficult to look at myself in the mirror. Making matters worse, parental support was absent. Raised by a mother she calls abusive, Winter was placed in the care of an older sister at 14. I went on to have a great rest of my teenage years thanks to being under her custody. Therapy has helped the actress move forward with her life, as has leaving Los Angeles. It holds some not great memories. Winter now lives with her boyfriend in a rural spot outside Nashville. She cooks, tends to 6 dogs, and works with the nonprofit Safe from Online Sex Abuse, which helps shield children from online predators. I've gone through some shit. My journey to healing is now through helping other people. That's all I care about. In the news, Bill Belichick's family is extraordinarily concerned about the North Carolina football coach's 24-year-old girlfriend and is digging into her background, former ESPN personality Pablo Torre said on his podcast last week. Their worries have grown amid reports that Jordan Hudson, a former college cheerleader, is micromanaging her 73-year-old boyfriend's life, weighing in on media interviews and standing beside him at Tar Heel practices. Citing a source close to the Belichick clan, Torre said, "The family fears Hudson could wreck everything the coach has built and worked for over decades." Torre claimed Hudson has been banned from Tar Heel practices. The university insists she's welcome around the team. Appearing on the Dan Patrick Show, Torre said one of his sources described Hudson as the worst person I've ever dealt with, and I've dealt with actual sociopaths. A Mississippi man who last week crashed his car through the front gate of Jennifer Aniston's Los Angeles home has been charged with stalking and vandalism. Jimmy Wayne Carwile, 48, is accused of repeatedly harassing Aniston, 56, over the past 2 years, sending her a slew of unwanted voicemail, email, and social media messages. Carwile's estranged wife, Julia, said he set off for California 6 months ago on a mission to meet the friend's star, believing that he was Jesus and that Aniston was supposed to be his queen. Aniston was at home at the time of the crash, but a security guard intercepted Carwile. He faces up to 3 years in prison if convicted. Return of the Wild Wolf. Gray wolves have been brought back from the brink of extinction in the U.S. Is that a good thing? How big is the U.S. wolf population? The lower 48 states are now home to about 6,000 gray wolves, concentrated mostly in the northern Rocky Mountains and around the Great Lakes. It's a remarkable comeback for an animal once almost wiped out by hunters. There were as few as 300 wolves in the contiguous U.S. in 1960, down from an estimated 2 million in North America in the 1600s. The species has also rebounded in Western Europe, where some 21,500 wolves now roam. But that revival hasn't been welcomed by farmers and ranchers, who say the predators threaten their livestock and their livelihoods. As a result, clashes over wolves have erupted everywhere, from Colorado, where voters in 2020 approved a ballot proposition to introduce 30 to 50 wolves over 5 years, to the European Parliament, where lawmakers last week voted to make it easier for farmers to shoot the canines. Wolf advocates say ranchers' fears are overblown. In 2015, wolves in Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho killed 148 cattle, 208 sheep, 3 dogs, and 3 horses. That's a tiny percentage of the hundreds of thousands of animals lost each year to illness, weather, and other non-predator causes. But Colorado rancher Jeff Myers says it's easy for wolf reintroduction supporters to dismiss those losses because few of them work the land. "It's not your calves that are going to be killed," he said. "It's not your border collie." Why did wolf populations decline in the first place? It was a product of manifest destiny and the westward expansion of the U.S. in the 1800s, which sought to tame the land and its wild inhabitants, said conservation biologist Mike Phillips. The hunting of wolves was aided by historical cultural prejudices against the animals, think Little Red Riding Hood. And even President Theodore Roosevelt, a famed conservationist, considered the wolf a beast of waste and desolation. The federal government subsidized the shooting, trapping, and poisoning of wolves starting in 1915, and by the 1940s, the animals were extinct in the Northern Rockies. Only a few hundred gray wolves remained in the U.S., mostly in the upper Midwest. How did wolves bounce back? They were helped by the birth of the modern conservation movement, which adopted the wolf as a symbol of the nation's disappearing wild heritage. We have a psychological need for something big and bad that represents wildness, said wildlife ecologist Jim Halfpenny. Wolves fulfill that. Wildlife experts also began to understand how the apex predators help manage an ecosystem, keeping in check deer populations that would otherwise strip vegetation bare. Thanks to the shift in public opinion, the wolf was among the first animals to gain federal protections under the 1973 Endangered Species Act. Their numbers steadily grew, aided by human intervention. From 1995 to 1997, 41 wolves from Canada and Montana were released in Yellowstone. The national park is now home to about 110 wolves dispersed among 9 packs. Park officials estimate that each wolf is worth about $1 million because of the visitors the wolves attract. Have they helped ecosystems? In Yellowstone, the wolves reduced the park's booming and overgrazing elk population. Some experts say that led to a trophic cascade, a chain reaction set off in an ecosystem by the addition or removal of a top predator. Doug Smith, former head of the Yellowstone Wolf Project, said predatory wolves keep elk on the move so they no longer linger by streams and gobble up new growth of willows, a crucial food source for beavers in winter. As a result, Smith said, the park's beaver population has increased, and those beavers have in turn created dams and ponds that become habitats for birds and fish. Other experts doubt whether wolves are really an ecological silver bullet. Daniel Stoller, Yellowstone's lead wolf biologist, said they are best have ushered in a trophic trickle. And residents in surrounding areas, where Yellowstone's packs often roam, say they've paid too high a price for any ecological gains. Hunting guides say the drop in elk has hurt their businesses, and ranchers that prowling wolves kill and also stress their livestock, reducing their weight. Under pressure from voters, lawmakers have moved to reduce protections for wolves. How have they done that? Congress in 2011 removed wolves in the Northern Rockies from the endangered species list, and wolves are now killed by the hundreds in annual hunting seasons in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. The Trump administration in 2020 removed gray wolves entirely from the Endangered Species Act, citing a successful recovery. And 4 months later, Wisconsin authorized a wolf hunt in breeding season. Hunters killed 218 wolves in 3 days, far above their 119 kill limit. And soon state legislatures in the West began authorizing wolf hunting. That flurry of hunting legislation was 1850s stuff, said Ed Bangs, a biologist who led wolf recovery in the Northern Rockies for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Let's show how much we hate wolves and the people who like them, and let's stick it to the feds. In 2022, a federal judge restored wolves' endangered species status outside the Northern Rockies. Can tensions over wolves be lowered? Compensating farmers for livestock killed by wolves can help. But Colorado, where wolves were reintroduced in 2023, almost depleted its $350,000 annual compensation fund after a string of attacks in the first 3 months of this year. Federal grants and state compensation program funds have also been used in some states to pay for electric fencing and non-lethal deterrence at ranches targeted by wolves. Many experts say that transparency and communication between farmers, Conservationists and government officials are key to human and wolf coexistence. Wolves can be tracked with GPS collars, for example, and ranchers told when they are near their property. Wolf recovery is all about people, said wildlife biologist Diane Boyd, and very little about wolves. More wolves, safer roads? Researchers have observed an unexpected benefit of larger wolf populations: fewer cars crashing into deer. A 2021 study that examined 22 years' worth of data from counties across Wisconsin found that collisions between deer and cars dropped by 24% after wolves colonized an area. That's because wolves tend to follow clear paths through a landscape, such as streams, or human-made corridors like roads and paths. By killing deer near roads, or simply by prowling alongside them, wolves seem to keep fearful deer away from passing cars. The drop in collisions saves Wisconsin $10.9 million a year, the study notes, about 63 times more than the state pays out in compensation for livestock or pets killed by wolves. The icing on the cake, said ecologist Leanna Zanette, who wasn't involved in the study, is that wolves do this work all year long at their own expense. Best columns, the U.S. The alarming threats to air safety. Jason Matzis, The Boston Globe. What's happening at Newark Liberty International Airport is not just troubling, it's terrifying, said Jason Matzis. A burned-out copper wire recently caused a 90-second communications blackout at a radar facility serving Newark, leaving air traffic controllers blind and mute while planes full of passengers descended into one of the country's busiest airports. Two more outages have occurred since then, causing hundreds of flight delays and cancellations. More than 20% of Newark's air traffic controllers have taken leave, with some reporting systems consistent with trauma, and they say the airport is unsafe. The FAA has a long-standing national shortage of 3,000 air traffic controllers who take 3 years to train, and these critical workers rely on antiquated technology that should have been replaced decades ago. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has announced plans to upgrade air traffic control systems nationwide, but that could take years. Only sheer luck and pilot skill have prevented tragedy at Newark. We can't keep gambling with safety. Until Newark is fully staffed and modernized, the FAA must reduce its flight schedule. Otherwise, the consequences could be swift, devastating, and unforgiving. A good death need not be hastened. L.S. Dugdale, The New York Times. As a doctor, I've seen intensive care units full of gravely ill people being kept alive by torturous artificial means, said L.S. Dugdale. So I support efforts to provide a better death. That's the supposed goal of the Medical Aid in Dying Act, recently passed by the New York State Assembly. But the bill, modeled on similar laws already in effect in Oregon and Canada, is not about dying well. Instead, it's about relieving society of responsibility to care for people in despair because of loneliness, poverty, depression, and disability. The bill would authorize doctors to give qualifying patients lethal drugs they can self-administer. But it doesn't require most recipients to be screened for depression. Of the 607 Oregonians receiving lethal prescriptions last year, only 3 were referred for psychiatric evaluation. In 2023 in Canada, hundreds receiving assisted suicide were people with disabilities who said they lacked support services, and half of non-terminal patients choosing to die cited loneliness as a factor. Offering a hastened death to people who see themselves as worthless burdens is not a compassionate policy. Instead, let's offer them a good death in which life ends amid support, comfort, and dignity. Seized by masked federal agents, Philip Bump, The Washington Post. The Trump administration is creating a secret police force of armed men wearing face masks and civilian clothing who grab people off the streets, said Philip Bump, This alarming, authoritarian tactic was seen on video when Tufts University student Rumeysa Öztürk, here on a student visa, was seized on a street in March and scheduled for deportation because she'd co-written an essay critical of her school's response to the war in Gaza. A court just ordered Öztürk's release, but she is just one of a growing number of targeted individuals who have been seized by federal agents who hide their faces and do not identify themselves. Trump has long made it clear he does not object to police mistreating suspects and has given Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents carte blanche to find, detain, and deport people by any means necessary. Allowing ICE and other federal agents to operate anonymously creates a culture of impunity that makes them less likely to face accountability for their actions. It's also an intimidation tactic that makes America feel more like Russia or China than a democracy governed by the rule of law, which is almost certainly not an accident. It must be true. I read it in the tabloids. A Greek woman filed for divorce after ChatGPT read the grounds in her husband's coffee cup and declared he was having an affair. After the pair, who have been married 12 years and have two children, drank Greek coffees, the woman suggested that, for a laugh, she upload photos of the sediment in the cups to ChatGPT for a reading, based on a traditional form of fortune-telling. When the AI said he was seeing a young woman bent on destroying the family, she demanded he leave. "I laughed it off as nonsense," he said, but he was soon hit with divorce papers and realizes this wasn't just a phase. He is contesting the divorce. A Kentucky mother was stunned when large boxes of lollipops began arriving at her home after her 8-year-old son ordered 70,000 of the suckers on Amazon. "I just about fainted," said Holly LaFavors of Lexington. Her son Liam spent $4,200 on 30 boxes of dum-dums for a carnival he wanted to have with friends. At first, Amazon refused to make a refund, but after ensuing media coverage, it agreed to give LaFavors her money back. "I can finally laugh about it," she said. Residents of a Turkish town became involuntarily stoned after police burned 20 tons of seized marijuana in the town's center. Thick weed smoke filled the town of Lice, population 25,000, for days, leaving residents dizzy, nauseous, and hallucinating. "We cannot open our windows," complained a resident. "Our children got sick. We are constantly going to the hospital." A local community organization suggested in the future police burn contraband cannabis in factories with filtered chimneys. Talking points. Hate pays. Making $770,000 from a racist rant. "It's a tale to make you sick to your stomach," said Parker Molloy in The New Republic. Shiloh Hendricks, a white mother from Rochester, Minnesota, went viral last week after she allegedly called a 5-year-old black boy the N-word at a city playground. Confronted by smartphone-wielding bystander Shamaik Omar, she doubled down, lobbing the same slur at Omar and saying she'd caught the 5-year-old boy digging through her son's diaper bag. Hendricks said she was justified in using the N-word, if that's what he's going to act like. After Omar posted the video on social media, Hendricks launched an online fundraiser, saying her family was being harassed. She raised more than $770,000, much of it coming from donors who signed off with racist usernames such as Nate Higgers and Unite the Whites. Hendricks has benefited from the same ugly patronage system for bigotry that previously aided right-wing causes célèbre like Kyle Rittenhouse. The playbook is simple. Do or say something awful, get rightfully called out for it, claim victimhood, and watch the money roll in. "There's a deeper story here," said River Page in the Free Press, "and it starts with the zealotry of the left, not the right. The past decade has been awash in tales of people canceled after being wrongly labeled as racist by an overzealous progressive mob. That doesn't apply to Hendricks, who is guilty as charged. But the righteous fervor of the woke era has triggered a backlash so intense that the right now celebrates racism. We see the same tribalism on the left, said Abigail Anthony in National Review. When a black teenager in Texas, Carmelo Anthony, fatally stabbed a white teen last month, his fundraiser received over $500,000 in donations, alongside messages such as, "Death to the white man." Some Hendricks donors want to counter-signal, while others want to protest Omar's setting of an internet army on Hendricks, which was more aggressive than screaming a slur. "Come off it," said Anthony L. Fisher in MSNBC.com. "Hendricks's backers aren't warriors against cancel culture. They're racists soaked in white grievance who feel liberated by the re-election of bigot-in-chief Donald Trump to engage in overt racism that was previously socially verboten." "I'm no fan of cancel culture," said Kirsten Fleming in the New York Post, "but neither am I down with making heroes out of murderers and racists spewing gratuitous hate. It's a dangerous trend that only encourages people's worst impulses. We all know how slippery this slope is." Noted. Quickly, we'll look at a couple more short articles. At least 44 contracts terminated by Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency have been resurrected by government agencies, reversing more than $220 million in supposed cost-cutting. On its wall of receipts, Doge lists 43 of those contracts as terminated and includes them in its tally of $32 billion in supposed savings. President Trump has met with intelligence officials for the president's daily brief only 12 times since his swearing in. That's a sharp drop from his first term, when he met with intel officials twice a week, and a rate well below that of his predecessors. Trump is also known not to read the daily briefing documents that cover global affairs, national security threats, and covert U.S. operations. Political. And that's all we have time for today.
This is Kathy Broughton, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading the week. Thanks for listening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info and audio/on demand. You can hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.